Father, this morning, as we get to this fantastic passage in the middle of Isaiah, please, Father, will you give us hope in Jesus Christ. Amen. Well, please do open up your Bibles to page 742, so that you can follow along this morning. Well, in my job, I get to hear the stories of lots of people outside the church family across the kind of town. Sometimes I hear their stories firsthand, sometimes secondhand. And there's so many needy people in the town who are really hurting, carrying heavy tragedies, or finding themselves in really complicated, messed up situations that just look so hopeless. Whether it's family breakdown, bereavement, loneliness and isolation, unemployment, mental health, health struggles or abusive, controlling relationships. The list goes on and on. I'm sure you're aware of many people in those kind of situations. Maybe you are yourself. What I find is that people in situations like that can, not always, but can become so fixated on the solution they've got in their head. Maybe the solution is, if only I can have a new relationship, a new course of medical treatment, a new way of getting money, or whatever it might be. You can become so fixated on that, and they're putting all their hope on that thing, that it's like they can't really hear anything else. You try sharing Jesus and the hope in Jesus with them, and it's just like it bounces off them. Do you know someone like that? And as Christian people, where we can struggle with the same kind of issues, and we too can be like that in our own way. You know, I can look at my problems and think, well, it's nice having Jesus, but what I really need is this. What I really need is this to sort my life out. Well, this Easter morning, I want to ask, is Jesus really the hope I need more than all other hopes? Is Jesus really the hope I need more than all other hopes? My prayer this morning is for our hearts to see that Jesus really is the big deal. We're back in the book of Isaiah. We're with the Old Testament Church of Jerusalem, 700 years BC, as Isaiah talks about the future, about stuff to happen. And he's talking especially about the coming of God's special servant, the Messiah, Jesus. Have you ever seen the James Bond movie, Tomorrow Never Dies? It's going back a bit. I think it's a 97 movie now. The bad guy there is a media tycoon, and he likes to write newspaper headlines before the events happen because he's going to make the events happen. Well, that's what's going on here in Isaiah 53. Our reading is a poem. It's the last of the songs about God's special servant. And in it, God is writing the newspaper headlines 700 years in advance. He wants to convince the people's hearts that Jesus really is the hope they need more than all other hopes. So the hope of Jesus this morning in three newspaper headlines. Number one, headline number one, Jesus came to reveal God's salvation. The very first word of the poem is striking. It's behold. It is a word designed to get us to sit up and to take notice. Ever since chapter 51, there's been this building sense of expectation. God's salvation, his power, his righteousness, himself is coming. We've seen how the world in Isaiah's day was such a messed up place, such a dark, messed up place. Jerusalem was a city that had been bruised and bashed around and battered by the different superpowers of the day, pushing their weight around. The people would end up being taken into captivity to Babylon. Yet we've been seeing that the real captivity the people faced is not exile in Babylon, is actually the captivity in their hearts. God had allowed the people to go into exile because the hearts had pushed him out. And so the city had become so messed up, so full of corruption, such a dark place. And we've seen how God could raise up a human dictator to let the people go home from Babylon, and that's what he did. But the salvation they really need is not from Babylon. The salvation they really need is to be freed from slavery to what their hearts are like. And only God can do this in the coming of his special servants. And when we've seen all that, and that's now being announced, behold, look, salvation is coming in God's servant. All this expectation is now going to be unfolded to us as we see what God's servant will actually be like. So 52 verse 13, behold, my servant shall act wisely, he shall succeed, he shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. His servant will come, accomplish his mission, and then he will be exalted. The pair of words, high and lifted up, were first used in the book of Isaiah back in chapter 6. That's a really important chapter in Isaiah. Remember there, Isaiah goes into the temple and he has this incredible vision of Christ the Lord on the throne. And all the angels around the Lord are crying out, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. And Isaiah falls down on his face as though he's dead. And there Isaiah says, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. Same pair of words. And so verse 13 of chapter 52 saying that God's servant will be exalted just like God. I mean, the servant's exaltation shows us that he really is God's salvation. And people really will need to be persuaded of this. Look at verse 14. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. This man is going to be so beaten up that his appearance would be unrecognizable. Now in chapter 53 verse 3 it says, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised and we esteemed him not. I mean, it's like one of those moments in a murder mystery on telly when the detective has to take a peek at the face of the victim. And the victim's face so kind of mutilated and bashed around that the detective turns to one side and has to throw up. It's so appalling to look at. So will people think of God's servant when he comes. They will be shocked and appalled at his appearance. Verse 15. Many across the world in the end will be overtaken in awe of him. I mean, what a contrast. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. So powerful an impact that he will have on people's lives that even kings will be stunned in silence at him. They will be in awe of him because of what he will come to do. End of verse 15. These people will understand that the God's servant is God's ultimate salvation for the world. 53 verse 1 tells us that the servant's coming is the arm of the Lord. The arm of the Lord is a way of talking about God's mighty power. In this first story of the Exodus, God comes and he does 10 plagues on Egypt and he splits the Red Sea. And it's God's mighty power which has done that, his arm. And now his arm is going to be revealed as a servant who suffers, is beaten and rejected. For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. I remember watching Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of Christ, with some students in China. I was over there. And they were new to Christianity. And having watched Jesus being whipped and beaten and mocked and crucified, they were stunned in silence. But read Isaiah, this chapter, and you know how to interpret what you're watching. The great story of Isaiah is that Christ the Lord, who lives in glory in that temple all those years ago, would come born into our mess, into our dark world, to save us from our mess. And we've seen how in Isaiah humans love to exalt ourselves. I mean, it's the very definition of the problem of sin, that we want, humans want to make ourselves God. That's why the world's in such a mess. It's why Jerusalem was in such a mess all those years ago. But our God does exactly the opposite. He who is exalted empties himself of glory and steps into our world. And then he rises again and is exalted up into glory forever. That crucified man is on the throne of the universe, and his resurrection is the doorway between his death and his exaltation. This year, Iceland got into trouble for replacing hot cross buns with hot tick buns. I don't know if you saw that. But let me say that a tick is actually a brilliant symbol for Easter story. Christ goes down into our darkness, only then to come up into glory forever. Let all this sink into our hearts. If you are new to Christian things, it's easy to in our world, just to write Jesus off. It's easy to see him as a man who's in the history books, an influential man who just met a sad end. And it's just not relevant to me in 2024. But Isaiah wants us to see that he is the hope we really need more than any other hopes, because of what he will do. We have our problems and our struggles. Why do we have them in the first place? Answer is because the whole world is in exile from God. All our hearts are far from him. And what the Old Testament church needed back in Isaiah's day was not to be freed from Babylon. What they really, really needed is to be freed from the problem of their hearts. They needed God's servant to come. Maybe you're here this morning and you're a Christian, but you know you've been drifting. It's really great you're here, really great. Is it that you've lost sight of how massive salvation in Jesus really is? I mean, all the problems and struggles in your life, they may well be big problems, and people carry really big stuff. I mean, what is it you carry at the moment? And let me ask, what hope are you clinging to at the moment? Is it that new relationship, that new course of medication, that new way of making money? Well, Isaiah wants us to see that the real hope we need is in Jesus. He is God's salvation revealed, and his coming was announced 700 years in advance. Headline number one. Jesus came to reveal God's salvation. Headline number two, Jesus died to accept God's judgment. I mean, the big question we have is, why must God's servant suffer? And the answer comes in the middle of the poem. People dismiss Jesus in verse 3 because they just assume his suffering is random or he deserves it. But now Isaiah shows us why he suffers. God's servant suffers because he is bearing God's judgment in the place of his people. The same thing said again and again in different ways, so we would not miss what is being said. Look at this, verse 4. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. I mean, let's zoom into some of those turns of phrase. Verse 4, he has borne our griefs. He lifts off us our sicknesses and all that torments us. Verse 4, he carries our sorrows. He shoulders our pain and our suffering. Verse 5, he was wounded for our transgressions. That word wounded implies a violent, excruciating death, and it happens for our wrong. Verse 5, he was crushed for our iniquities. The word for crushed has the meaning of being broken into pieces. And again, it's happening because of our evil. I mean, these verses are like the beating heart of the whole 66 chapters of Isaiah. And to see that, just stand back and see the big story of the whole book. In chapter 1, we learnt that Isaiah is a tale of two cities. It begins with an old Jerusalem that's turned away from Christ who lived with them. And so it's become a city full of corruption and evil. And it ends, the book ends with a new Jerusalem that loves Christ and is filled with his goodness. And here's the key thing. The same words we get here in verses 4 and 5 were used in chapter 1 to talk about the people of Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem. They've turned away from Christ and they've ended up being a sick, bleeding, dying people. I mean, here's chapter 1. Why will you still be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick and the whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot, even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They are not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil. I mean, it's picture language, isn't it? To talk about how the different superpowers of the day had bashed Jerusalem around, bruising them and beating them up. And it left Jerusalem just bleeding and dying and sick. You know, chapter 1 carries on. It says, God allows this to happen. He allows even the people to go into exile because he loves them. It's his discipline on them. He wants to change them so that they will be able to live with him forever. I mean, how do you get from the old city to the new Jerusalem? Well, the answer is the exile. The exile is God's refiner's fire that burns away evil to make his people new. His exile judgment is the only way to change their hard hearts. But now in Isaiah 53, we see that God's servant will bear God's judgment in our place. He will go all the way through the fire of the exile. He will become sick, bleeding and dying, as it were, in their place. I mean, notice the middle of verse 5. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. That word chastisement means to correct. It's the word used for fatherly discipline of a child. It's correction by words or even correction by punishment. And it must be that punishment one here. As God's servant bears God's exile judgment in the place of his people, so he experiences God's correcting discipline for them. I mean, we've seen in recent weeks how God cut short the exile because they just couldn't bear it. He took away the cup of God's wrath and he gave it instead to his servant to drink. And the result, verse 5, is peace and healing. God's servant dies as the great sacrifice. That's why in verse 6, the imagery becomes about sheep and sacrifices. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Each year on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would take a goat and lay his hands on its head, pressing down and confessing over the animal all the sins of the people. The high priest would lay on the animal all the sin of the people of Israel. And now for real, God lays on his servant the iniquity of us all. I mean, it's a bit like, imagine for a moment that this big book is a record of all my wrong. All that's wrong with me. And this is me. And it sits so heavily on me. What a great weight. But on the cross, what happens is a great swap, that God's servant bears the weight of all my sin on himself. Now, what verses 7 to 9 want to tell us is that God's servant willingly took it for us. Jesus knew it wasn't his own guilt. He knew it was totally unfair, yet he took it for us. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. by oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. He just pauses there and gazes at his love for us. Jesus willingly accepts God's judgment for our evil all the way down to death. Verse 7, he's like a sheep that does not even make a single bleating sound as he goes to the slaughterhouse. God's servant goes as a sheep that submits to what is happening to him. Yet he does not go as a helpless victim. He goes willingly to fulfill God's mission. What's more, his willingness is absolutely crucial to God's servant to complete his mission and to bring us salvation. I mean, in recent weeks, we've been seeing that God cut short the exile in Babylon because the people were going to be completely consumed in the refiner's fire. It did not work because the people refused to accept the exile as God's discipline. Yet God's servant does what is so against human nature. I mean, we play down our evil, don't we? We make excuses for this, that, and the other. But Jesus fully accepts God's judgment for our evil all the way to his death on the cross. And so in him is the cure to heal our hearts. It's a bit like there's a deadly virus that's spreading across the world. It's infecting everyone. And Jesus comes along and he says, inject that virus into me. And so his body fights the virus on the cross and he overcomes it. And now he says, use my blood as the cure. And so these verses set out the heart of the meaning of the cross. The people go into exile and refuse to accept it as God's discipline to change their hearts. But God's servant comes and accepts God's judgment in their place. And so in him is the cure to heal their hearts. And what he does for them, he does for us. Chapter 52, verse 15, he will sprinkle many nations. He will sprinkle them with the blood of his sacrifice to cleanse their hearts and make them new. Jesus came to reveal God's salvation. Jesus died to accept God's judgment. And headline number 3, Jesus lives to share God's righteousness. I mean, I thought this was Easter Sunday. Where's the resurrection? Well, it comes here in this very last section. It's where the whole poem is heading. The suffering of the servant was all to fulfill God's plan. And so the servant's death is not the final word. Verse 10. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Because God's servant willingly and fully accepts God's judgment for us, is offered up to God as a pleasing sacrifice. His death satisfies God's justice. All our debts are paid by his perfect obedience. And so now God rewards his servant. His death just cannot be the end. And that's what verses 10 to 12 are about. I mean, back in verse 8, it looked like the servant was left with no descendants and how he was simply cut off from the land of the living. He was left dead and childless. But now in verse 10, we see how he shall see his offspring and he shall prolong his days. Death is not the end for God's servant. It's talking about Jesus' resurrection. God's servant dies, yet he will live. And he will see the completion and the fruitfulness of his work. Verse 11, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. In his resurrection, Jesus will say, job done, mission accomplished. Now I can enjoy to see all the fruits of my hard labor. And that fruit comes next. Verse 11, by his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. And he shall bear their iniquities. The many there is talking about all those he dies for. They are his offspring. God's servant dies childless, but he rises to be the father of a new family. No wonder he's satisfied. It's like he's come and rescued children from an abusive situation. And then he takes them into his home and he makes them his children forever. See how it works. He lays down his life for the many, and so the many become his children. And now he makes them like himself. He is the righteous one, says verse 11. And now he makes them righteous like him. They really will be chips off the old block. I mean, righteousness is about God's overflowing goodness. And the problem with the old Jerusalem, it was just so full of unrighteousness. But the new Jerusalem will be transformed. It will be a city of righteousness. And here in Isaiah 53, it tells us how that will happen. God's servant will act righteously. He will accept the judgment in their place. And as he goes to the cross, bearing all their guilt and sin, there is no greater act of overflowing goodness than that. There is no more righteousness can be found than in the servant. And so his righteousness, God's righteousness, is stamped onto him deeper and deeper. So as he rises from the dead, he is the power of righteousness. The risen Jesus now shares God's righteousness with his people. He clothes us with his goodness. Imagine for a moment, we had it before, how we had this illustration of him taking the weight of our guilt. That's part one. Part two is that as he does that, it is the most incredible act of righteousness. It's like he's covered with a perfect white garment. And then as he rises from the dead, what he does is he uses this to clothe us as well. He clothes us with his righteousness, with his perfect goodness. He died to cure our hearts. He rises to put God's power of righteousness in us. I mean, we often think of Jesus' resurrection as winning a great battle over death, and it is that. But he doesn't just die, he dies accepting God's judgment. And so when he rises, he doesn't just beat death, he rises to share God's righteousness with us, that we might be people who live for God. Romans chapter 4 verse 25 says, Jesus was delivered up for our trespasses, for our sin, and he was raised for our justification. In him, we can be made new people because he covers us with his goodness, with his perfect obedience. And so Jesus becomes the head of a new family. Start of verse 12 is better translated. Therefore, I will apportion to him the many, and the strong he shall apportion as spoil. We here are the rewards. We are the spoils of his victory. Jesus rises from death to become the head of a new family. And it is his family he delights in forever and ever. In his resurrection life, we are his great reward. We are his people, his family. And so the poem ends where it began. Remember where it began? Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall succeed. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. And now we see that as he goes up from the dead and is exalted up onto God's throne, he carries us with him. What better hope could we have this Easter morning than being part of his family forever? He died, taking away all our guilt, cleansing our hearts forever. He rose to clothe us with his perfect goodness and to make us part of God's family forever. What better hope could we have than that? Amen.